Hello, my lovely listeners. It's been a bit longer than I would have preferred since you've heard my voice, but life gets in the way, and I am currently happy to tell you that I am in the middle of programming the next season of my podcast, which is going to be titled Sex on Screen, where genre cinema and porn collide. Keep your eyes and ears peeled for future information about this series as I plan its release. But in the interim, I have a special bonus episode to drop for you. Last year, shortly after Frightfest 2023, I recorded a fantastic conversation with John Adams and Toby Poser of the Adams Family Filmmaking Collective. And originally I was thinking it would be a bonus episode to release onto my Patreon, but the more I thought about it, it was such an enlightening and fantastic conversation that I didn't want to deprive it from the public. So I'm releasing it now as a bonus episode on the main feed, and I'm excited to put things in motion for the next season. But I hope you enjoy this enlightening conversation with two amazing filmmakers. Hello, and welcome back to Fishnets and Philosophy. This is your host, Mix Bell Morrigan, and I am joined today by Toby Poser and John Adams. So, before we can jump into a full conversation and discussion, if you could just briefly introduce yourselves to the listeners who may not be familiar with your work, and your just kind of general connection to filmmaking and the horror world.
Sure. Well, I'm Toby Poser. I'm in the Adams family, but I'm a poser. I'm a mom and partner and just one of the mix here with the Adams family and the films we've been making.
And I'm John Adams, and I'm dad. I'm a filmmaker with my friends, but mostly I'm just friends with my family. And that's the luckiest thing about like being here talking to you today, is that we're allowed to kind of do art together, our family, and we get to have fun talking with people and traveling around and making horror movies.
I love that. That leads us into one of the questions that I sent over. Like, I'm really interested for yourselves. Like, what was it that prompted you to start creating art as a family? Was it something that you have like always done, or was there like a moment where things clicked into place and you realized, oh, this is actually something that we'd really want to pursue?
I think really what happened was we've always been artists, Toby and I. And so our kids, when they were born, were already born into kind of an art world where that's what they saw and that's what they were surrounded by. But we came to a part in our life where it was getting harder to like make a living and doing art. And it was kind of like as if the permission doors were closing, because in fact, our age was increasing to the place where you don't get as much permission. And you're not as sought after, or you're not as, you know, there's a lot of doors that close as you get older. And our kids were interested in like being painters and actresses and things like that. And so all of that coincided at a perfect time where we decided, let's not ask permission to do art. Let's just do art and see how it goes. So we made our first film. All four of us set out together. We bought an RV, drove around America, and basically learned the ropes of filmmaking together. Zelda was 5, Lulu was 10, and we were, how old were we? In our 40s. We were somewhere in our 40s. And we fell in love with it. And so that's what happened, is the four of us just set out on a dream together, and it turned out to be beautiful.
I love that. And I love the way you phrase that so much about, you know, let's not seek permission to do art. Let's just do art. Like, that's just inspirational type language. And I love that so much. And like, for myself, like, my dad is like a painter. Like, so he's like artist, like he, you know, does oil paintings. So like, art has always been a big thing in my family as well. So it's really interesting seeing the way artistic families, like how the desire to create kind of gets passed along from like parents to children, and it gets nurtured. And it's just, I just love what you all do. It's really cool and really just inspiring seeing people go, yeah, no, you know what? We don't need permission. We're just going to do what we want to do. I love that. It's such a great message. And it's just like really cool to see where you've taken it. But kind of going back to the first question, slightly different kind of tangent, but because I know from yourself, like looking at your filmography as like filmmakers of the family, you started off with more dramatic type stories, and then you've started going towards like the genre films and horror, which is what I think a lot of people now think of Addams Family. They think really cool, innovative horror films. So for both yourself as individuals, this is a question that I'm having on my current ongoing Why Horror series, and it's something that I just love everyone's own answers, because it's so unique and you get to know what people, like you get to know more about the person you're speaking to. So for yourselves, what was the first horror film that you remember watching? And then slightly adjacent to that, because sometimes the answers are different, like what was the first horror film that you watched that made you fall in love with horror as a genre?
This is a double-edged question, maybe triple-edged. I'll have to mention two, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
The first one I saw in a theater was Sleepaway Camp. Although, I'm jumping ahead here, it really didn't inform the ending of our film. It just was the first one I saw in a theater. I think I was 14. My mother would never have let me go on my own, but I was visiting a friend in New Jersey, and she was cool and fast, and we went to a horror film. And so I was completely just like, you know, gobsmacked and like, oh, this is cool. Partially because it felt so, it felt transgressive just to be sitting in the theater. It felt dangerous since I wasn't allowed. And I was just kind of thrilled. And my eyes sort of bled a little bit, and they've never stopped bleeding. But the other one I need to mention is something called The Incredible Two-Headed Transplant, which was on Sunday. We had like creature double feature where I grew up. And so there would be like black and white, you know, horror films and weird, trippy stuff. And I would sit there with a spoonful of peanut butter and I would watch creature double feature. And that was the one that really got under my skin. And I couldn't take my eyes away. I also wasn't allowed to watch it. So I was watching it quietly. And so that made a big impression upon me. And in it, this is also strange because it is about this kind of sort of lumbering guy who isn't educated and some might say it might be called back then, I guess, a simpleton, you know, and he gets the bad sort of lusty criminal's head transplanted on his. So you've got two heads on one body.
Wow.
Well, again, maybe subliminally, a lot of stuff is going on with these two films.
Interesting. Okay, cool. for yourself, John, yeah.
Yeah, for me, the first horror film that I saw that just blew my mind and scared the hell out of me was Phantasm. My coach, my soccer coach, took me and his kid and a couple other players to see Phantasm, and it was terrifying. And it's funny. I know that also has a huge influence on every film that we've made. I think also subliminally, like I don't say like, oh, I want to do something that is a quote of the tall man, or I want to shoot something that, you know. But it's more like a lot of the time we'll be done with something and I'll realize what an effect that had on me. So your question's a really good one. Like, what's the first horror movie you saw? But what's the first horror movie that influenced you is such a great question. So I would say subliminally, I'm influenced by Phantasm. But I think really the first film that influenced me was more of a Western, but it was horrible. And it was called The Proposition. And Nick Cave wrote the script. And I remember when I watched it, what I loved about it was just how dirty it was. It was a dirty film. And the violence was no cutaway violence.
Right.
And I think that I still chase the tone of that.
Interesting. I love that. And again, I really like the way you've rephrased my own question, like in a way that I didn't think that I was getting at, but I really like that. Thank you so much. But no, I love both of those answers. And yeah, I've loved every person I've had on the podcast asking that question, because it's such like interesting way of like getting to know horror fans and why we come to this genre, what drives us to seek out these type of films, or in your cases to make these type of films. And you've probably already touched on it a little bit there by saying that, you know, films like The Phantasm subliminally influenced you and like what you kind of like, I guess, the tone and stuff like that you're trying to create with films. But for both of yourselves, who are your like artistic inspirations, like both as filmmakers but also as musicians? Because that's the really cool thing as well, that you're musicians and you like create that for your films too, which like is just so unique. But yeah, so who inspires you like when you're creating your art, whether that is films or music?
You know, I'll mention music real fast. I mean, John is really our wonderful writer. He's just incredibly prolific, and it's so much fun being in a house with him. Just this morning he was listen to this, and it's just, I just love, fall in love with him all the time when he's playing me a riff. Anyway, but
I know my way to my girl's heart. Listen to this fuzzy guitar.
I love it.
Yeah, baby.
But what I like musically, and I've written just a few songs for our films, and they're very simple. And almost like childlike. Actually, the musicians that influence me are very theatrical. Like they have this storytelling theatrical nature, like Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, or Tom Waits, or even like the band Rasputina, which, you know, their songs sound like they're spinning a spell. And so I like songs and music that tell a story. I'm thinking of like in the Bad Seeds, Stagger Lee, or you know, it's just like he's telling a story more than just something I love to listen to.
Yeah, for me musically it's a simple answer, and because it also has to do with our filmmaking. I saw a band called Black Flag in 1983, and it just completely changed my life. And it changed my life because it opened up a whole new door of culture and mindset and music. But ultimately, as I learned more and more about Black Flag, what I learned and really fell in love with about them is that they were in charge of their own destiny. They are from the 80s, and that was when the music industry was the most powerful, and they wanted to make a certain type of music, but the music industry was never going to allow that. They would have had to shine up what they did, slowed it down, and made it more saccharine. And what Black Flag did was they were like, nope, we're gonna do this. We're gonna book our own shows. We're gonna record our own music. We're gonna make our own record label. We're gonna make our own posters. And then even furthermore, they cultivated this amazing crowd. Mm-hmm. And here I was, they're a band from, you know, California. I'm a kid from upstate New York, and somehow I found them. And that's amazing. And that still informs us, which is just do it. Like, once again, it's back to the whole question of, we're not going to ask somebody permission. Like, we're not going to ask somebody, hey, is this a good idea for a movie? Is this, you know, should, you know, is this good music? Is this good that? It's more, what's beautiful about the horror community is they're very accepting of art. Like, they allow people like us to take chances, even with our low budget and our disadvantages. They want to see what we're going to do, and they may not like it, but there's an accepting crowd out there. And so I would say that's what informs me from the music world, is that early hardcore do-it-yourself ethic that comes across today and is celebrated amongst horror fans.
Before I go into my next question, I really want to pick up on that. You're so right about the horror community as a whole, as opposed to like any other type of community around film. Like, I've noticed that the horror community is like this it's like this kind of like rebellious crowd of like very much like, as you said, it's embracing art, like horror fans champion horror, even if it's like not their specific favorite subgenre. It's like, we've got new horror being made that should be celebrated, and it's more so than any other type of genre of film, like horror fans will rally together because they just want to see more new horror being made, and I love it. And yeah, I love that you've been embraced with open arms by so many people in the horror community. It is really cool. But the next question that I'm kind of leading into, which you've again touched on by talking about not needing permission, just doing, creating art because, as I said, it's just what you want to do. Like, for yourselves as creatives, as artists, like, I want to know, like, is creating art, is it something that, like, it's a need? As in, like, it's almost like you have to do it? Or is it something that you just enjoy doing it and you're just doing it for now? Or is it something that you don't see it ever stopping? Like, creating art is, like, a lifeblood almost for you.
Well, for me, I enjoy it. Yes. Like, of course, like this creating art is pure joy, but it's also something that I have to do too. And I'll just be honest, to avoid sinking into darkness. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, if I just continually am creating something, dark thoughts don't come into play. And that's just the way it is. And I've really learned that more and more and more as I've grown older, which is, don't leave any room. Always be overwhelmed with creating. And that way you're never overwhelmed with tough thinking.
Yeah, no, 100%. I can so very much relate to that as well. It's one of the reasons why I asked it, because again, like, it is just creating. It's like, it's something that just drives you. It's a need. And it's like, you know, I'm in this weird situation where it's like, I'm still involved in the kind of 9-to-5 capitalism rat race. Like, I still have like a civilian job, but then that's why my need to create art of any kind is like so much stronger, because it's like, it's the only thing that stops me from focusing on that. I'm still in this situation that I don't want to be in, but I have to be. But yeah, no, I love that. And for yourself, Toby, is it like, when it comes to creating art, is it something similar? Like, is it this driving force for you, or is it something that it's just a joyful thing? Like, what, like, where's the overlap for yourself?
It's definitely something I'm driven to. I guess the farthest back I can remember, I've just loved anything that was creative, that required the imagination or reaching deep inside of myself. Mm-hmm. To pull out, again, there's always sort of a storytelling aspect to my creativity, because I started in acting and that's a way of completely changing who you are, you know, and finding all kinds of identities within yourself, whether you're playing a serial killer or not. You're reaching in and pulling things out to create another character. So even though I'm not a great painter, let's say, or I'm not like a brilliant, you know, natural songwriter like John, those things are just still so important to me. And yeah, I couldn't, once I started acting and just playing make-believe with mud pies in my backyard, I knew that there was something I had to do. I always had to get my fingers into the dirt and muck of creativity. And yeah,
I'll say something also about the horror crowd and about this subject that we're talking about, which is, I find that there's a huge slice of the horror community that are very deep thinkers, and they like to talk about, they like to think about tough issues, like, you know, it's a boring word, but like trauma but philosophical issues. One of the great things about the horror community is that we're all talking, well, you know, at least a nice big slice of the horror community, we're all talking about pretty deep things, but they're covered in horror. We're talking about it through art. And that's so positive. So like, we're talking to you, and like, we can already tell with our conversation with you that you have the same probably struggles with darkness that like I do. I won't talk for Toby, but it's like, what's great about that is you find companionship through art with a very large group of people. And that's empowering for all of us.
100%. I love what you're touching on there as well. Because like, I think, like, for myself, like, when I think about horror as a genre, as what it does, like, how, you know, the type of stories that we can kind of tell through horror, through art, like, you know, for me, horror as a genre of storytelling, of filmmaking, has always been political in some way. It's always talking about something, it's always commenting on society. You know, horror is the subgenre that, like, you know, turns the mirror towards society, and it's like, you know, reckon with what's happening in the modern day. Like, that's what horror as a genre does. And I love how even films where it's not on the surface, if you look into it deep down underneath, it's still talking about things. And it's such, like, an interesting genre for being able to tackle societal issues or interpersonal issues. So yeah, no, thank you for that. That was really interesting. And actually it leads into one of my other questions, which I'm wondering for yourselves, like, because I know for me, when I'm creating any of the art that I am creating, whether that's writing or like performance, like I do burlesque and pole dance, or even like kind of like my modeling type work as well, I'm aware that I'm always like channeling a part of myself, or I'm channeling myself through the art that I'm creating. And I want to know, like, for yourselves, like, when you create these characters for your own films, like, how much distance is there between creation and creator? Like, is it, you know, are these characters, is there a part of you in the characters, do you feel, or do you just let the characters breathe on their own?
It's such a fun question. And I have to say, first of all, you should meet Lulu, because our daughter Lulu is a great pole dancer. She
Cool.
And it's a very, very important part of her passion and identity since she started it a couple years ago. So I hope you get to meet her and she gets to meet you one day.
Oh, cool. Thanks.
No, well, on the surface level, there's always an undercurrent of autobiography in our films. You know, we are a family, and we usually make films about families. So there's often something we're saying about our family. For instance, with Where the Devil Roams, we've got parents who are getting older. It's a daughter trying to come into her agency and understand what is she going to do, perhaps without her family, or what can she do to keep them together. You know, Hellbender, The Deeper You Dig. There's always something autobiographical there. But on a personal level, I always find something within my characters. It kind of goes back to the other thing I was saying. Like, I loved playing Maggie. She's still in my bones. I am not a serial killer. I don't want to
imagine. All the killers say that.
I don't want to enact violence against her, but I can bring something to her. And in a strange level, I understand. I always understand where all the characters I'm writing and playing are coming from. And I think that makes them more human, whether they're considered good humans or not.
Yeah, I think all of our films are, you know, documentaries about ourselves, or autobiographies, or diaries, however, whatever word you want to use. And the thing about it is, like, playing the characters, I don't think they're very far off from who we are, including Toby being a serial killer, because it's not, obviously she's not a serial killer, but it's, she had to be a serial killer in order to show the depth of, like, my and her love. So yes, she's not a serial killer, but the depth of my and her love in those characters is what's true. Mm-hmm. And for an audience to understand the depth of our love, and that's what's beautiful about horror, is you can paint it in blood and very quickly it becomes more illustrative. Like, we can all understand it a lot better. And that's what's different about drama. Like, if you're making a drama, you have to do a lot of talking and a lot of, like, blah, blah, blahing. At least to me, it's blah, blah, blahing. But, you know, obviously a good drama is a good drama. But what's nice about horror is you can set this woman up, her, as a serial killer, and you can show me that I can't even look at blood, and yet I'm deeply in love with her. And so that's exactly who we are, because we're talking about everybody's frailties and faults, and that's what true love is looking at each other, your family, and their faults, and still loving them with no
unconditionally.
Right.
I'm loving that, and, like, you know, I think it's so true, and you can see it in your films as well. Like, with in between the different characters you've created, they just jump out of the screen, but also just talking to yourselves, I can see that, you know, that you have this deep like love and connection to each other. So it's really cool how you reflect it through these characters in the films you make. I really like that. That's a really powerful and touching answer for it. And so actually kind of stemming from that, actually, this is actually a really interesting question to lead into. This is another question that I've had on my Why Horror series. But I want to know, like, for yourselves as filmmakers and artists, like, do you feel like, because especially because there's so much of yourselves, as you said, your art is autobiographical to us to an extent. There's so much of yourselves in the art you create. For yourselves as filmmakers and artists, like, do you feel that once the art is out in the world, it belongs to the audience and their interpretation, or will your ideas and intent kind of always exist in tandem to whatever audience interpretation there is?
It's the coolest question, and I think they do exist in tandem. I mean, obviously, once it's out there, people don't need to know anything, may not know anything about us, and they're going to receive the film as they like, and that's cool. And I think that's what art, poetry, music should be. But we really like inject our films with so many small subliminal pieces of us that I feel like they have to still somehow influence what people are taking away from it. For instance, The Deeper You Dig, people might say, is a film about a mother trying to get back, or a daughter who is killed trying to get back in touch with her mother trying to reach her daughter. But for me, I was going through a reproductive cancer while we were shooting that. So that film goes way deeper than what is on the surface.
Yeah.
For me, that film's incredibly personal. And I can't help but feel that that injection of personalness informs what people subliminally at least receive from that film.
Everything that Toby said, I completely agree with. But my last thing about is it our film or is it their film? Mm. Like is I think it's best illustrated by this for me. We live in the middle of nowhere. We don't really have internet. Like right now, we're talking to you from my parents' house because they have internet. We don't have a telephone. We don't have a TV. We like being up alone. It's very hard to get up our driveway so no one comes and visits us, right? So we live in this kind of isolated world. And that to me is our movies. Like that would be like, that's what our movies are, because we're kind of isolated. We don't work with a lighting department or a sound guy or a cinematographer or a producer or anything like that. We're just this isolated little bubble of filmmakers. There's four of us, me, Lulu, Zelda, and Toby, and then actually Trey. So there's five of us who does our effects. But the point is like when I live up in our house, I don't know, this is going to sound weird, but when I go to town to buy food, suddenly I realize what I smell like. Because everyone smells so good. And suddenly for the first time, I'm so aware of like, oh my God, you smell like a human. And they all smell really good.
You smell good to me.
Yeah, and that's it. But that's the point. Like, so there's the point. It's a very weird point, but boy, it makes total sense to me.
No, I get that. It's such like a really, that's a really interesting point, and I just love that little anecdote. But yeah, that makes it so cool. But also, I think it's why, as like someone who like you know. Had only just kind of like watches your films, is an audience member to your films, like I think it's why it makes them feel so unique, in the sense that, because as you said, it's like these things that are just made in isolation, they're like, there's less of the kind of outside external influences, they just exist in their own little bubbles. And it's why you can tell, like, even if you didn't know, you'd be able to watch an Addams Family film and go, oh, this is an Addams Family film, because it just has your signature on it. And I love that. But no, that's a really nice anecdote. That's really, really interesting and fun. But it really puts the point across. And that actually, it does kind of like lead into another question then, because given that so much of the films that you make, as you said, they are made in isolation to everything else. It's just yourself as a creative family working together. And this is one of the questions that actually jumped into my brain after watching another movie the other day. I watched Alex Noyer's Sound of Violence, and which was a really interesting, captivating film about kind of like music and killing. And but basically, it got me thinking, when it comes to making music, both just as a band in general, but also specifically for your films, like, which comes first almost, like in a chicken and egg scenario? Is it that like you have the music piece comes first, and that's what that ends up influencing how a scene goes? Or do you have the scene created and the music then comes from that? Like, how does it work? How's that creative process for yourselves?
It mostly used to work. It's changing slightly now, but it always worked like once we came up with an idea of what the movie was. Like, for example, The Deeper You Dig. This is going to be a movie about a guy who kills a girl, hides her away, and the girl fights her way back to the spirit world towards her mom. We knew that. And it was like, so I just sat down and I just started writing tons of music with that in mind. Kind of open-minded. Do you know what I mean? And basically, like, I would write 50 songs and eight of them would work. Eight of them I know would be right, and the other 42 would hit the floor, you know? And the girls would always, you know, they sing on this stuff and they're a part of it too. So we all kind of would be like, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? Mm-hmm. And so by the time we started editing, I already would have a lot of songs. And so we would put them over the visuals to see how they worked. Mm-hmm. And that used to be how we worked. But for Where the Devil Roams, we wrote actually a little later. Like we started filming and then we started writing. And the reason was because we all became more intellectually involved with what the sound of the music was going to be. Mm. And so the four of us were more working in tandem about what we wanted. The girls were singing. We were laying down the music. We were showing each other ideas, you know, and it turned out that like, and we actually tried a couple different musical styles and they failed. And right. So, and this next movie actually that is all, we're doing the same thing. We're actually writing the music now instead of beforehand. So okay. It's a great question. I don't know which one I like better, because there is something nice about having a library of songs and just putting them over visuals so you can just see how it feels. What do you think, Tobe?
Well, I'll say this about Hellbender. Before we made the movie Hellbender, we were making a music video for one of the songs, Black Sky. Mm. And it just, there was this really great witchy vibe that was poking through. And John was coming across some fun editing techniques. And we just realized, oh man, this is so cool. The movie really kind of blossomed out of that video.
Yeah.
That's okay. The case. Where it was like, oh, we were creating music and then a video for the music, and we realized, oh, there's a lot more here, and that became the film.
Yeah.
I love that answer, and it seems to be something that's fluctuating and changing. It isn't just like pinned down as one structured process. Like, that's just really interesting. And again, it just shows how creative you are as a family, as individuals, that it's just creating is what you do. And I really like that answer. Thank you so much for sharing that with me. And what you said there about how at first you were making the music video, but then it kind of led to the idea of, oh, this could be a really cool movie, and like how everything kind of influences each other when it comes to a creative process. Like, it's something that I think a lot of moviegoers and film fans are not really aware of how much goes into making films and how difficult it is to actually kind of go from idea to a film now exists in the world. And it's a film that can like play Fright Fest, for example, and stuff like that. So I want to know, like, for yourselves as filmmakers, like, what kind of like insights would you like people to be more aware of, as in from the behind the scenes process?
Well, I would say the most important thing about filmmaking, this would be more addressed towards people who want to make a film, is that it's millions and millions of small steps. Like, And that is just what it is. You can never be in a hurry. You can never rush it because there's so many. We're very lucky because we do just work with the four of us. So like we have time on our hands. Like if we fail in shooting a scene, we'll just shoot it again. And if we fail that time, we'll shoot it again. And it's like always what becomes more and more and more clear is, at least with our process, is just making sure that each step you take is high quality, even if you have to do it over and over and over again. And when I say high quality, I mean high quality to what we can do. You know what I mean? Like high quality might be different. Like somebody might look at, and people do look at our films and they say, oh, it's not high quality. But for what we can do and what we want to do, it's really important to us that we say to ourselves, that was high quality, you know, for everything that we could do. So I don't know. That's really the way I feel about movies right now, is just that it's those small positive steps forward. Never be afraid to take a step back and then keep going forward.
I would also say that it's important. There are ways to tell a story beyond dialogue, what is just said. Have you ever read that tiny little one sentence short story by Hemingway? It goes something like, baby shoes for sale, never worn. It's like a short story in one sentence that you get so much from those few words. And I think film can be a lot like that. It's not just the information you're trying to feed people by what is said, it's what you're making them feel by what is seen and heard. And I think that's really important, because some of my favorite movies, they're not fancy, they're not flashy, they just hit me. They hit me somewhere. And I want to be hit. And I think if people know what their story is and are trying to convey what's inside them so it can be inside someone else, they have a good shot at making something great.
Also, this is a good time to point out once again that the horror community is super film educated. So they can watch like a Hollywood slasher and love it. And like, oh my God, it was so great. There was 13 people killed. It was super bloody and I loved it. You know, and they can watch a movie shot on an iPhone by a kid from, Oregon State University, and also say, ooh, I love this movie, The Shaky iPhone. There was no kills in it at all, but I love the psychological aspect of the main subject. Like, what's really fun. Now, obviously, everybody in the horror community doesn't love every movie and they can tear movies to shreds, but that's all part of it. Generally, they will watch it and they are film educated. And that, I think that the horror community is the one film watching community that doesn't really need to be educated on how difficult it is to make a film, because they're very accepting of all different types of film.
And you know what makes, like, for me, what makes one horror story perhaps better than another, let's say there were identical films, but someone made it and they really didn't believe in their horror. They didn't believe in their monster. You can tell that difference from the person who made that same exact film but really believed in their monster. The actors believed in the horror. The actors believed in this supernatural monster. And I think that's important for filmmakers too, to believe in what they're putting out. We talk about it all the time, because if your characters don't believe in what they're doing within this lens of horror, then it's just gonna look like farce and fake. You have to like feel it in your fucking like guts
that are spilling all over the floor.
I love that. And you've said, both of you said so many great, like, there's just like so many amazing things that you've just said that I'm just like, I can run so many different directions. But I think what really resonated, and specifically what you said, Toby, a few moments ago, was about, like, you want to be hit by something, you know? And like, I think for me, and this is a quote that like my listeners are probably like, gonna like roll their eyes because I've used it so many times over the last while of my last series. But Joe Hill, the author, who's Stephen King's son, like, one of the quotes that he's known for saying a lot of the time is, the purpose of horror is not to create fear, it is to create empathy. and the whole point that you're supposed to care about the characters so that you fear for what they're going through. Like, if you don't care about the characters on screen, well, then what's happening isn't really going to be as effective for you. And I think that's really kind of what it comes down to, what you're saying, Toby, about you want to be hit. Like, a film, you need to be moved by the film. That's what, like, I think what us as horror watchers, as horror fans, I think ultimately that's what we're seeking. We're seeking to be moved and affected in some way, whether that's feeling like fear, feeling sorrow, whatever it is, we want to be moved. And, like, you know, horror films that, like, don't reach that level of affecting us are the ones that tend to slip us by. They're the ones that don't stand the test of time in many ways. But what you said, John, was really interesting as well about, as you said, horror fans, like, they'll still watch it, you know, they'll, even if it might not be their specific thing, they'll still seek it out and watch it. Because I think, and as filmmakers, it's something that you're probably acutely aware of as well, but horror, as opposed to any other type of genre, like even studio, like big studio horror, is the type of, like, genre of film that studios go, you don't need that much money to make it. We'll just give you this tight budget and then whatever you can do within it. And I think that's why horror jumps off the screen so well, because it's people who care about what they're making. And, you know, you can tell, like, it's like, we've got this limited amount, but what can we do with it, rather than wanting more. It's like trying to do the most with what you have, almost. And, like, I just think that as filmmakers, that's something that jumps off from the films that you make as well. But I just want to know, like, for yourself, and I know this isn't one of the questions I had prepared down, but it's just in my brain now, but for yourselves as, like, filmmakers, is that something that ever, like, crosses your mind when you're making films, that, like, do you ever feel like you're restricted, or is it more, we're just gonna do what we want to do and let the story tell itself?
You know what, I think I speak for both of us. We don't feel restricted. In fact, I think limitations are freeing, because you really use what you have, and you can be creative with what you have. And then you're just focused. I always say this, that you're just focused on your story, because you're not thinking, well, I have a huge budget for lots of, like, fireworks and lights, and then a big, like, dinosaur comes out. You know, like, we could do lots because we have so much money. It's like, no. Actually, I feel more free with less of a budget, so we can really make a story, and we don't need all the, you know, all those distractions. I mean, they're fun. I'll go to a blockbuster film, absolutely. But as far as when we're creating, I think it's, our limitations are actually a gift.
Yeah, I agree with Toby. And also, it's like, look, I love watching a big Marvel movie, or, you know, some super $50 million horror movie. But I can't help but look at it these days and just think, oh my God, it looks like work. It doesn't look like anybody's having any fun shooting this. Because, and for me, I love the lower budget, harder movies to make that we watch on the festivals. I think they're amazing. And there's just something so much more visceral and honest about them. And when I watch the more expensive movies, for me, I see too much. Everything's given to me too softly. It's like, I don't love it. It doesn't hit me, as Toby just said before, and you said, it doesn't hit me. It's like, it feels like I'm eating a McDonald's burger. It's like, no matter where I am in the world, they always taste the same. And they kind of taste good on the first couple bites, but by the end of the McDonald's burger, I really don't feel very well. And then I'm hungry.
Did you see The Moor? I bring that one up because that's a film that didn't need, I don't know what their budget was. I don't imagine it was huge, but they didn't need anything extraneous, because just where they shot, and the director at the beginning said something fun that sounded, rang so true to how we shoot. He said, we were there and suddenly this great mist came in and it felt very dangerous, and everyone said we should go, and I said, no, now's when we shoot. And it was a cooler shot in the film. And so just the nature, the horror, the terror, of being in that boggy, misty, wet, succulent atmosphere was terrifying. I mean, it really scared me more than I've been scared for a while. And part of it was just where they were standing. And, you know, we don't have lights or anything. So there's also something to be said about the energy that comes with working with the elements, you know, instead of like electricity and the light that you have, depending on that, there's something really great for us who don't have a big budget. Working with like the spontaneity of nature is very exciting.
Also, you know,
it does heavy lifting.
When you have a big budget, those crews are expected to spend it. So that means you are going to use all those lights. You are going to use an expensive camera. Everyone is going to go to makeup, hair and makeup. The clothes are going to be, you know, so it's like what happens is slowly but surely everything gets shined up. Unless you're really like expert and you know how to shine everything down. Now, I think sometimes there's big Hollywood productions that know how to shine things down. But I think mostly everything gets shined up and then we're watching basically a Disney horror. And I think that it's really fun. What I love about the horror community is they like dark shots. They they don't mind a blown out sky. Like all those things like are definitely celebrated. And that is once again, like kudos to the horror crowd.
Everything you're saying there, so many really powerful great points, and again, some great like anecdotes and analogies. But it comes into it leads into one other question that I had, and I'm interested to see what your answers are, because both of you've talked about your creating these stories and what, you know, how you allow the story to influence yourselves and just the process as a whole. For yourselves, when you are like crafting the stories that you depict on film, like how much of it is like a kind of a specific kind of meticulously planned out process versus allowing the characters to dictate where the story takes you? And I'm wondering, like, have you often been surprised by where you've ended up at the end of a project in comparison to like what your ideas were at the start of making it?
Oh my God, yeah. I have a fun anecdote. So our first film, Rumble Strips, which we shot in 2010, and Zelda was 6 and Lulu was 11. we started out, that was meant to be a ghost story. And in this story, the children get killed by the character John plays, and it was really fucking dark tale. So that was the year we took off, and we were living in an RV for a year and trying our hands at making a film. And we were having such a glorious time. We're driving in the RV. John turns to me, he's like, Toby, I got to tell you something. I really just don't want to kill the kids. And I was like, I don't want to kill the kids either. So that is a very bold example of where we did a complete about face. And we just weren't ready. Obviously, a few films later, we were ready to kill the kids.
It's a great, that's a great question that people don't normally ask the way you've put it. And without a doubt, we start out, that's why we kind of rush into our films a lot, because you don't want to think too much. You just want to rush in and get moving and very quickly learn like what's good about it and what's bad about it and who you really are as a character. Like even the last movie that we did, Where the Devil Roams, we filmed a whole bunch of stuff. We filmed a whole bunch of scenes in the beginning. And as we looked at it, we thought, like my character especially was like, no, this looks fake. It's not good. We need to change him. And we did. And I love the character now. And so, yeah, we definitely like to put things up on the editing bay. And they'll tell you, they tell us whether it's honest or not. It's really important that like we're honest.
Yeah, we're not working from a full script.
Right.
Almost ever. And that's cool because we'll have an idea and maybe we'll have just like a template of a scene to jump off from, but it always changes because everyone who's playing their character has great opinions and insight. They're going to know better how something's said than A, B, or C will. There's something cool about it just kind of unfurling as we make the film. We kind of let the film sort of like, it feels kind of like a seance in a way. It's sort of like poured out. It's like, oh, please, you know, gods of horror, Show
demons
yourselves.
Of horror.
Are you there? And it's sort of like eventually they kind of come in and like, yeah, I'm here, try this. And then you sort of like, you know, build your story from once you get sort of possessed by whatever the spirit of the film is meant to be.
Hellbender, we didn't even know the ending until we shot it. And literally Zelda said something. We were down trying to shoot it. We kept shooting the same thing over and over and it wasn't going well. And then Zelda said something else and was like, oh my God, that's the ending. We didn't know it until Zelda just off the cuff said something. And then suddenly it was like, oh my God, that's the fucking ending. And so, yeah.
And where the devil roams, it took a while to get to the ending. When we did, we were really exhilarated, as you can imagine. But it was right before we shot the scene. John, we didn't have music yet for the spell that had been said a few times during the film. And so right before we were shooting, John was there with his guitar. We were sitting in our dining room, living room, all the same in our house. And he's just making up a tune for the song. And then a half hour later, we were shooting it.
Yeah.
Wow. I love that. And like, that was kind of like when I asked that question, that was kind of the answer. I was hoping that it is just this kind of fluid and flux process where it just informs itself rather than because like, you know, you can, I think you can kind of coming back to what you were saying, John, that like, you know, you watch some of the kind of like, I guess almost like bigger budget kind of horror films and they kind of feel like a McDonald's burger, you know, and I kind of think that's the same thing. You can tell that these are films that were, you know, A to B to C to Z, like they know, had a specific thing that had to be followed and you can kind of tell. So I love how your films, like as a family, everything that you create is just this existence of creation almost. But this actually leads us into what Joel B is our wrap-up question, and it was something that you actually kind of prefaced earlier, Toby, by talking about the first film you saw was Sleepaway Camp. But you're talking there about the final scene of Where the Devil Roams, and it's something that stuck with me, and I was wondering like ever since seeing it, and it's almost like a week ago now that I saw it and it's still in my brain which shows how affecting it was. But want to know, like, as like filmmakers, like at all in any way, like were you like influenced by the ending of Sleepaway Camp, or is it just very kind of coincidental that it's like a like very different shots that kind of almost they're almost like a yin and yang, like kind of cousins. They're not related at all, very different things happening, but it's that similar type of like boom and then cut to credits. Like, I want to know, was that there an influence there at all? But then stemming from that, now this could just be me as a very queer philosophical person, I could just be completely reading into it and it may not be there at all, but like seeing that Frankenstein image at the end of the kind of like body cobbled together of like both the mother and father characters, like I want to know, like, was that at all like a commentary on queerness or gender, like as in that bodies are just bodies, there's, you know, there's nothing to them, they're just bodies, or is that just my own reading into something that wasn't there? That's two big questions, but
the answer to your second part of your question is we are completely, absolutely aware and celebrating what you just talked about. But we were already celebrating it in The Deeper You Dig. We celebrated it in Hellbender. Like, we're, again, I know I talk about the horror community too much, but I think it's one of the most wonderful communities because of how inclusive it is. Like, I don't find all the, you know, barriers that I find in regular life in our town, in our cities, in our things. Like in horror, I do find this super wonderful inclusivity, if that's a word. And we're here to celebrate that because you have to, because it's beautiful. And yes, we're so aware of what that last image means. But we're also so aware of that it's completely loaded. It's like a bomb that goes off in a lot of different directions. You know, some are dark, some are light, some are beautiful, some are ugly. And it's like, that's a sweet bomb that we loved setting off.
amazing. And for yourself, actually, Toby, because you did preface it, like, I wanted, like, was there like any, like, even a subliminal possible influence of Sleepaway Camp? Or because even if there wasn't, that's even cooler. If there was, that's also cool, because such a seminal film in horror history.
There was not. I mean, I had to really kind of be reminded, because I'm, what, 53 now, and I saw that 14.
Well, don't tell me what the ending is, because I haven't seen it. He's actually never even seen it.
Oh, okay.
If there's any comparison tonight, that's going to be our movies.
Yeah, you should watch. I'd love to watch the end. But I had kind of, no, it wasn't part of our thinking at all. You know, I think that final scene can be up to interpretation from everyone, which I love. I know how I see it. I think it's her masterpiece. You know, I think it's her masterpiece. And it's, you know, it's a culmination of it's you know, gender. You're in a time too when in the Depression where people had certain roles, you know, as women and as men, as males and females. And I think this just transcends all of that. And she's made her beautiful masterpiece.
Yeah. And it's important to us to play with things like for most of the history of horror movies, just even what you see at the end, we've watched women be kind of objectivized in horror movies. And so it's like a lot. So we wanted to have a fun thing about that. We also wanted to have a fun thing about look who the A killer is. Usually it's the man who's walking around slaughtering people. But in this movie, it's her. You know, she's, in a sense, there's even a scene where she wears the pants in the family. She's the MC of the family. Like, she puts on something to show that she's the MC. You know, kind of in a sense, like, I wouldn't call it it's fun that Seven can't deal with violence. Do you know what I mean? It's fun to strip away the things that we're all used to and then just turn them on their heads. I mean, the whole movie's about standing on your head and looking at everything.
And everyone comes together. The two people that Eve loves come together in the way she thinks is most beautiful. And it's just it's in a film that has a lot of stitching and cutting and sewing. It's a fun culmination, I think. It was really fun to, when we had that aha moment. It's like, ah, there we go.
And then the problem with this question is, see, you can go on endlessly about it.
Yeah.
And that's why we have so much fun with it, because you could also ask the question is this what the devil wanted? Or is this what God wanted? Or does God hate this? And does the devil like this? And if the devil likes this and God hates this, then who's correct? It's like, that's what the whole movie is like about. And it's really... And that's what's so fun about the horror community, is that these are fun conversations. And here you are in Ireland, and here we are in upstate New York, and here we are talking about it.
Yeah, we also, I'm just going to keep extending the conversation, but, you know, we start out on a list. We in the poem at the beginning, it's clear that, you know, we talk about Abaddon as male, and he falls in love with a woman. But in the end, it's sort of like, oh no, let's erase gender from the equation here. This, you've been seeking your lover. Well, this is the evolution of what your lover, and it's also the master, you know, puppet that she herself is making. It's just really fun.
I think a terrific kind of resounding kind of point to kind of like wrap up the conversation on. I just love that so much. Because that's actually all the questions I prepared. There are so many different things and tangents I could go on, because you've said so many interesting things. But actually, it was something I was like wondering, especially from looking at your films and how transgressive your films are. It's not one that I prepared, but I'm interested to know what your thoughts are as filmmakers are. But it seems to be right now, there is kind of like a current like hot topic issue about, you know, discourse online about like sex scenes on screen and sex scenes in films and stuff like that. And I want to know, as filmmakers, like, what do you think about that? Like, because you mentioned earlier, Toby, and I think it was really beautiful point how you said that, you know, not everything is about plot. Like, you know, not everything is about what's said in dialogue. You know, it's about what's seen and how that story is told by what you see on screen. Like, do you think, you know, because I see a lot of this phrase is bandied about a lot, and it says, oh, you know, was that sex scene necessary because it did nothing to advance the plot? And I want to know, as filmmakers, like, do you think, like, what's your view on that? Like, do you think that viewing everything as advancing the plot is almost like a detriment to making art, to making films?
My answer is, like Toby mentioned it before, which is getting hit by a scene. I love getting hit by an honest sex scene.
Mm-hmm.
Like between two women, between two men, between a man and a woman, between, you know, kids holding hands, whatever. It's like, it's whatever it is. If it's honest,
mm-hmm.
then I fucking love it. If it's gratuitous, I can pass.
Yeah. I think that's the perfect way to sum it up. Because, like, I think for me, you know, when it comes to, like, you know, like sex, intimacy, sexuality, it's part of the human condition. It's just part of living. It's part of being a human. So why wouldn't that be something that happens between characters that know each other in a story? Like, you know, it's a human thing. So yeah, like, that's kind of always my response. Like, it doesn't need to necessarily move the plot, but also intimacy is plot advancing, story advancing, because it advances the story of those characters. They get to know each other better and stuff like that. But anyway, that's a whole little tangent.
There was a TV show that was just on that we watched that was really fun, and it was the best sex scene I've ever seen. The Last of Us, yeah.
Yes.
There's two guys, and one of them's like a real redneck, but then they slowly develop, like, yeah. So you, that already comes, like, what I love about it is, and then this is why it was honest, was because you know, so you see this kind of redneck and who loves guns, and he's so you think you know everything about him, mm-hmm. and then they just develop this great story and then lay out this terrific sex scene that's so intimate and caring, and it's like, it's so great. So yeah. There's an example of that's how it's done. Whereas last night we watched an old movie from the 90s, and I'm not going to disparage like who made this movie, but I had to endure like these stupid fucking sex scenes that were just so gratuitous and so gross and so like,
there's no, like, chemistry.
And no, mm-hmm. yeah, but also it's like, I could tell that the director is just a horn dog who just like wanted to see this actress. And it was just dumb. And it was like,
yeah,
made me really fucking annoyed.
Yeah. In that case, I would rather see something. I mean, I'm all for like, I mean, sometimes it's about the lack of intimacy that makes mm-hmm. a scene.
Oh yeah.
And we learn about a character that way. But if anything, like, if it's not going to be kind of like John says, honestly done, I would get more out of, did you ever see that movie Carol with, it's a lesbian love story, and it's with Cate Blanchett and that, Mara Rooney or her sisters? I forget. Anyway, right. The woman, the actress from Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Phenomenal movie. And there's a scene where they're just sitting across the table from each other, and just how they look at each other took me miles further than if they were naked in bed together, you know. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, there's something just that to be said about intimacy that is not done in a sex scene that often is even more powerful for me.
100%. That's actually such a good point. And that's something, like, just again, this is a little mini tangent, but then I'll let you go because I know you're very busy. But that's such a good point, that, and it's something that I've reflected on a lot during my last series. But, you know, I feel like in so much of the movies that, like, mainstream films that we're getting these days, like, it's almost like intimacy doesn't exist anymore between characters. Like, even both, like, and whether that's like actual, like, full on sexual intimacy or just like non-sexual intimacy, but it seems to be something that's less and less in existence. Like, you know, I can think back to, you know, you watch any of the films from, like, you know, the 60s, 70s, and 80s and stuff like that. Even films that didn't have nudity on screen, but you could like see characters and you could almost like imagine the second the camera leaves, those characters are ripping each other's clothes off because there's this intense chemistry between the two people on screen. And I feel like so much of what we're getting these days, we don't really see that anymore. And I don't know where it's coming from. And I think it's part of a wider, bigger issue about this whole sex scenes on screen discourse. Like, it's all influencing each other and it's related to our capitalist hellscape that we're in. But it's something that I feel like we don't get it anymore. And it's really, that's why, again, I just want to say like a big props to like what you're doing with your own films, because your films feel so transgressive and they're doing something different that most films these days are not. And I just, like, you know, I applaud you for it because it's really interesting and impressive.
Thank you, Val. Thank you so much.
Cool. Yeah, it's so great. Boy, that's something I'm going to think about what you're saying, because that's a great thought about what you're talking about, intimacy and cinematography. You clicked something in my brain that's important. That was good.
And you know what? A representation of nudity on screen, I think, is really important, because I get really bored of only seeing your stereotypically like young nude people. Yes. Or young beautiful people. Like, it was important for us in this film that the two older characters, who are John and I, start out nude and end nude. He especially ends nude, but we all have that quick. You were introduced in the raw and very, very raw. And I feel like more emboldened as a mid-50s woman to be nude on screen more and more. Not because it's like I want to shove it in people's faces or to prove anything, but it's just, I'm human. I'm here. There are millions and millions of 54-year-old women in the world, and we're all nude at, you know,
and we're
some point of our day.
Like, back to the very start of this conversation, is we don't have permission. Our age group doesn't have permission to make it on film. Our age group doesn't have permission to do a sex scene. So obviously then we're gonna fucking do it, because it's like, great, we've been denied permission, so we're gonna do it. Another thing, I don't know about Ireland, I can't speak to Ireland's like climate on things, but I can say that the American climate is super censored at the moment. Like, it feels like 1950 or even further back in a lot of ways. And so it's like, when that happens, it's really important to break the rules and let people know out there, it's okay. Like, this is crazy that we're censoring, even just what Toby just said, like, we're going to censor a 55-year-old woman's body. Like, no, we're not.
Yes, I'm like doing the silent like preach, because yes, I'm loving those messages, and yes to everything. And yeah, instead of going on another hour long tangent and talking to you about so many different topics,
we're gonna have to make another movie so we can watch out. Now, because of this conversation, we're gonna, you know, I can
no,
see
but honestly. Honestly, like, this, like, that was such a great positive place to end this conversation on, of just like, we don't need permission, we're gonna fucking do it, and we don't need to censor bodies. It shouldn't be something that is being done. And I love that you are, through your art, your filmmaking, you're basically putting up two big middle fingers to that and kind of like just continuing to do it, because that's what you want to do. So before I let both of you go, where can people like kind of find you and kind of support your work? And if there's any upcoming like projects that you'd like to kind of plug, let people maybe make them aware of, now is, you know, you're at the altar is yours.
Well, first of all, thank you so much, Belle. This has been really a cool way to spend an afternoon. And you've got us thinking about so many fun things. Our band is hellbender.com, and all the E's are sixes. And then our website is wonderwheelproductions.com, which shows the full spectrum of all of our films. And you can see trailers, lots of photos. Social media, on Instagram we're adams.family.films, and on Twitter we're adams_films, And then we're just individually on Facebook.
Thank you so much from the bottom of my heart. This has been really cool. I'm very happy that you've reached out and said yes to coming on. I'm still like kind of pinching myself that it happened. But no, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. And yeah, I will let you know when the episode is going to be released, and that way we can be, you know, shared and all that. And to my listeners, keep your eyes and ears peeled for future seasons that I have planned.